Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza, working from home on this pre-recorded program, very remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, March 8, 2021. Residents of South Sudan's capital, Juba, are penalized for not following COVID-19 preventive measures.
Instead of fining the citizens, let the government at least give them free masks as other ordinary countries are doing.
And South Sudanese women complain about gender balance.
Whether they're governors, they're all male. Whether it's the head of the state, you know, it's a male. So, and yet, when we were actually advocating for that, we worked together collectively with them. But then in the implementation now, it's not reflected.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Residents in South Sudan's capital, Juba, are expressing mixed views about the penalties the government announced last week for breach of COVID-19 preventive guidelines. The National Task Force for COVID-19 says people who fail to wear face masks or take a COVID test when required will be fined. While some support the move, others say the fines are too high and the task force has done very little to educate people about how to prevent themselves from COVID-19. For VOA News, Winnie Chirino reports from Juba.
The COVID-19 task force last week announced new restrictions to curb the spread of the virus. It now says anyone who fails to wear a face mask or observe social distancing rules will be charged 6,000 South Sudanese pounds. An unauthorized health facility found admitting confirmed COVID-19 patients will be charged 60,000 South Sudanese pounds, or about $100. Juba resident Nancy Gassim says it is unfair to impose exorbitant fines on citizens when it is clear that most civil servants earn less than $10 a month, which is often not paid on time.
Instead of fining the citizens, let the government at least give them free masks as other ordinary countries are doing. Then the curfew time, we find most of our people are living from hand to mouth. You find the women on the street making the fish, And they're staying on the streets making porridge at night up to until like 11 or so. And so where will they feed their family from?
Nunu Diana, an activist with the national NGO Young Positive South Sudan, says the penalties announced by the National Task Force are completely baseless because the task force hasn't done enough to educate the public about the pandemic.
People are living on a perception that COVID-19 is not a reality. So I think the National COVID-19 Task Force should have informed these people about the dangers and the effects of the COVID-19 in the country by going deep at the grassroots level, at the market areas, that is where people are crowded, but they haven't done enough. They've not installed water points around markets for people to ensure that they wash their hands. They've not distributed masks to ensure that people have to wear these masks while in crowding.
Diana says several government agencies don't adhere to COVID-19 directives. She says offices of certain ministries are often overcrowded with many people sharing one room. Diana says the new fines are intended to rob the public. Patrick Malley, a Boda Boda rider in the Tongping residential area, says the penalties will negatively affect the incomes of Boda Boda operators because a majority of passengers do not have face masks.
As Boda Boda guys, we are facing a lot of challenges, especially masks. You know, there are some other customers who can even not afford to buy what? Masks. Right now, when we are to take person from Tongping to custom, at times even paying that money for Boda Boda is even challenging. So I'm suggesting that at least the government should at least help the community by supplying some masks for the community so that we shall also be safe, in other words.
Malay says the masks are expensive. He says the cheapest ones cost at least 1,000 South Sudanese pounds. Dr. Richard Laku, chairperson of the COVID-19 Task Force Committee and the incident manager in the National Task Force, says the complaints on the high prices are not genuine because the task force has tried other measures, but the public has not respected the orders. He says they are fining people to protect people's lives.
So why are they complaining, why do they not want to wear the mask in the first place, to say that it's high? They were told politely they don't want. 6,000 is not high with the lives and risk of the individuals. When we're going to lose a life compared to 6,000, 6,000 is nothing.
Juba resident Gabriel Yokwe says he supports the government's decision to impose penalties for non-compliance with COVID-19 restrictions. He says the fines will force people to take the pandemic seriously.
I literally observe the measures set for my own safety and for the safety of the people around me. So looking at the fines doesn't necessarily surprise me or make me feel uncomfortable at all. It rather reminds me that I should still always observe these things, and it's mainly for the purposes of my own safety and the people around me.
Yokwe says the amount of the fines shouldn't be an issue, arguing it is much cheaper to buy a face mask than paying the fine for accessing a public place without wearing a mask. The task force also says people who violate curfew hours will be detained for 24 hours to undergo sensitization about the dangers of failing to adhere to COVID-19 protocols. For VOA News, I am Winnie Sirino in Juba.
Women in South Sudan are marking International Women's Day by calling on authorities in the country to appoint more women to positions of power to achieve gender equity in the country. A former Eastern Equatorial State official says it's difficult for young women to enter into politics. For VOA News, David Monodanga reports from Juba.
Josephine Akulang Abalang, the former Information Minister of Eastern Equatorial State, says the biggest challenge women leaders face is that they are not fairly represented in government, as stipulated in the revitalized peace agreement. She says some states barely appointed 15% of women into their local government structures, even though the peace deal mandates that 35% of positions at all government levels be filled by women.
Whether they are governors, they are all male. Whether it's the head of the state, you know, it's the male. So, and yet, when we were actually advocating for that, we worked together collectively with them. But then in the implementation now, it's not reflected. So that's one of the big challenges, because as long as we continue to not have women in all those key positions, you know, decision-making positions from national to state to even technical positions, then women will always continue to lag behind.
Abalang adds that society is also responsible for holding women back when people expect women to take care of all household duties. Pony Victoria, Communications Officer for ICAP Global Health Institute, says some civil society advocacy organizations also abuse women's rights.
For example, an organization that has an element of gender equity doesn't treat its female staff in the same way or in the same manner of which they are advocating for women outside to be treated. This is one of the biggest challenges we face. So there is a way that people tend to believe that the work you are doing is different from the life you are living. So you are not supposed to benefit from what you are advocating for.
Victoria says the patriarchal system is deeply rooted in South Sudanese culture, to the extent that women advocating for people's rights are viewed as aliens or westernized women. She says it's all the more disappointing that some of the resistance comes from women. Victoria says civil society and government officials must unify the country's constitution, which contradicts customary laws, making it difficult for authorities to enforce the country's laws.
They should stop hiding behind the shell. They should stop keeping quiet. That is one of the biggest steps. If we get more men coming out to the front line and talking to other men, that look, what we are doing is not right. These are our wives, these are our sisters, these are our mothers, and we are humans like them. If we get men talking to men about how men are treating women, I think that can be one of the biggest steps that can be taken forward.
Abalang says patriotic citizens should ensure that women's rights are enshrined in the constitution as a guarantee for future generations.
The upcoming constitution-making process, we need to ensure, not just as women, including people who care for this country, to ensure that all that is actually incorporated into the constitution. Because if it's just left to, because agreements can be implemented and then they end up, you know, fully being implemented if we are lucky enough, and then it then that's the end. But what normally guides the country is the constitution.
Juba businesswoman Vanna Jovi says many women fail to get hired because they are not confident enough to present themselves as professionals or during business presentations.
I train much women as possible on tough ethics and confident how you can be a very powerful woman in front of public. You'll be able to present yourself. And this is one big thing a lot of young female are lacking here. Mm-hmm. The fact that you stand in public and present yourself and everyone must have a different look at you other than just looking at a beautiful woman, but looking at a strong professional woman standing.
This year's theme for International Women's Day is Women in Leadership, Achieving an Equal Future in a COVID-19 World. It celebrates the efforts by women and girls around the world in shaping a more equal future and a recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic. For VOA News, I am David Monodanga in Juba.
As the world marks International Women's Day today, Monday, amid the COVID-19 pandemic, we take a look at Kenyan women who are coming up with initiatives geared towards empowering women. For VOA News, Maureen Ojiambo reports.
According to the report by the United Nations Development Programme on International Women's Day, women must have the opportunity to play a full role in shaping the fundamental decisions being made right now as countries respond to and recover from the COVID-19 pandemic. And during this pandemic, a Kenyan lady, Bella Chieng, founder of Bella Rafiki Foundation from Homa Bay County in western region of the country, has put up a fully furnished library as well as an agricultural group for widows. All this is to ensure women and youths in the society are empowered.
We do poultry and livestock keeping. We grow crops such as sweet potatoes, maize and groundnuts. Then we sell them locally. And this way, the widows who are in my foundation are able to fend for themselves. How I came up with an idea of making a library, it is an idea that came from the widows. They saw that this is a problem in our community. And for them, knowledge is power. So we built the first ever library that is going to serve this whole community.
Bella says insecurity in the area is a setback as some community members are making it difficult for the initiative to run efficiently as some are stealing materials meant for the project.
Challenges that we've faced so far are financial and insecurity. This comes in where some of the community members themselves are getting into the library and stealing the books even before we did the launching.
The United Nations says countries must break the deep-rooted historic, cultural, and socioeconomic barriers that prevent women from taking their seat at the decision-making table to ensure that resources and power are equitably distributed. Another lady, Sheila Kinuthia, founder of Phoenix Halfway House, was falsely accused and imprisoned, but later acquitted. She came up with Halfway House to help women who go through domestic violence and those released from prison to be in a position to fend for themselves by helping them to secure jobs.
I started the Halfway House because I'd met a lot of those women in prison.
We deal with women who are from violent domestic relationships, women coming from prison who have no other place to go. So it's a transitional home. And their stay there is 3 months or less. We give them training for jobs. We also give them counseling until their next destination.
On the other hand, a communication specialist, Sheila Raymond, who has written stories on girls from the slums in Kenya, has come up with a plan to help girls who perform in school continue to pursue their dreams. She does this by paying school fees for them.
Many parents living in the slums are not able to support their children through high school. And so what I decided is I am going to pay school fees for at least 3 girls in all the schools that have dance mentorship sessions. I do this from my own pocket. I don't have any donor so far, but I hope in future I will be able to get someone who will be able to come and join me and so that we can be able to reach many more girls.
The United Nations says structural discrimination such as persistent gender stereotypes and gendered expectations, norms and attitudes remains a significant barrier in equality between women and men. Reporting for VOA, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, what are Nigerian women doing to survive? That story is coming up right after the break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
name something that you haven't tried but hope to someday.
I never drive a car, but I hoped to, because I've grown in a poor background, and in my life, I desire to do so.
I want to travel from Uganda to a different country because I've never moved out of Uganda. Yes.
I've never tried bungee jumping, but I would like to try it one time.
I've not tried paragliding before, but I would like to try it someday, being at the top of the mountain, jumping and flying in the sky like a bird.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. It's a time set aside to honor women both in their role as breadwinners and as mothers who nurture their children and care for their health. Other NGOs in Nigeria say women must choose between breastfeeding their babies or go to work.
This is the question I asked as well when the project was introduced to us by NECA, Working with Alive and Thrive. When we started the project, I thought it was going to be easy to just get organized private sector to take this on and set up a crèche or a lactation center within the organization such that a woman that is very, very talented, skilled, competent within a team will not be lost as a result of being in the child-rearing period of our life.
So what happened?
We had a lot of organized private sectors that were for. But, you know, we had a lot also that were against. I said, no, we don't need it. It's going to be a distraction for the women. And they lost directors, managers, because immediately after their 3 months maternity leave, they had no choice but to stay back with their children.
It couldn't be good for their businesses to have those women leave.
Losing a competent and skilled staff contributes to the bottom line of any organization.
But what about women in the informal economy, in the shops and markets, in agriculture, and in more rural places generally?
Yeah, the informal sector. We have the market women, the women that they have stores, they have shops. Most of them have their children with them. I want to say that this will be something that Alive and Thrive should actually look at to see how within an organized market, there can be a crèche. I can come into my store, drop my child, go check my child because it's just within the mall or within the market.
So overall, how well would you say the activism for this national law is going?
So there's a lot of progress, but you know, 4 states out of 36 states is still a far cry. There's a lot of work that still needs to be done.
The proposed national legislation is a lot more women-friendly than the U.S., for example, which has no national maternity leave mandate for either public or private sector employees. Are other West African nations following the Nigerian model?
I don't have validated research with respect to that, but I must say that Nigeria is actually always at the forefront of a lot of things.
Would you be content with a system where a mother would be given 3 months paid leave, then given lactation and childcare accommodations when back at work?
I'll go for both approaches, depending on the capacity of the organization. I'm for the 6 month maternity leave, but then there are some organizations that are not at that level. Once we can pass the bill at the national level for a 6 month, then every organization will not have a choice. After the 6 month, when you come back, you are supposed to breastfeed for another 6 months if you can, and then to be able to continue breastfeeding for more than 2 years.
What kind of feedback have you gotten from the public sector women in the 4 states that now allow 6 months maternity leave?
Oh, it's made a superb influence to them. You will see a lot of civil servants excited about this. The negative feedback probably might be from the small businesses. Small businesses might not be able to cope at the moment, except you have a national framework that is legislated. At that point, everybody will have to go with it.
Any final word for our African listeners on this International Women's Day?
Let us continue to challenge the status quo. promote participation within democracy that will ensure women's leadership and economic equality. Number two, women must develop themselves such that once such opportunities are available for them from the leadership and economy, they would be able to step up their game based on their competencies and their skills set. And thirdly, every organization, both public and private sector, should actually be seen from the perspective of inclusion and diversity.
That's Modo Pei Oyaile, the national coordinator of the Association for Nigerian Women Business Network. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips. Pope Francis celebrated the Mass in front of an estimated 10,000 people at a sports stadium in the Kurdish capital of Erbil on Sunday. It was the final full day of Pope's much-anticipated visit to Iraq to offer solidarity with the country's Christians and other religious groups amid ongoing turmoil of revival militia battling the central government and firing on demonstrators in the streets. Edward Iranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
A choir chanted to a crowd of thousands of Iraqis gathered to hear Pope Francis deliver Mass at a sports stadium in Erbil, despite a minor rainstorm. Kurdish and Iraqi leaders, along with some foreign dignitaries, also attended. Francis urged everyone to help those who are suffering and in need.
Per ripulire il cuore abbiamo bisogno di sporcarci le mani.
Francis says that we must get our hands dirty, acting responsibly, and not standing idly by, watching as our brothers and sisters suffer. He added, it is clear that the church is alive and that Christ is here among his holy people, going on to say, this is one of the reasons why I felt compelled to visit you and thank you. Francis said, Iraq will always remain in my heart, and I ask all of you to work together for a future of peace and prosperity that excludes and discriminates against no one. He also said, here in Iraq, so many of your brothers, sisters, friends, and fellow citizens bear the wounds of war and violence, and only God can heal these wounds.
Viva el Papa!
Earlier Sunday, during a visit to the Christian town of Karakosh outside the northern city of Mosul, the Pope blessed several young people who were in wheelchairs amid chants from the crowd of Long Live the Pope. In Mosul, the Pope addressed a crowd in front of a badly damaged church, urging Iraqi Christians to return to the city and help rebuild it. Thousands of Iraqi Christians left the country after the Islamic State group gained control of vast swaths of northern Iraq in 2014. A top church leader, Iraqi Chaldean Bishop Basil Yaldo, thanked Francis for his willingness to visit the country despite the ongoing turmoil there and global issues.
We thank you for your courage that you would come here to our troubled land. A land so filled with violence, this place of endless disputes, displacement, and suffering among the people, and that you would do this in this time of global pandemic and crisis.
Khatar Abu Diab, who teaches political science at the University of Paris, tells VOA that the papal visit is largely symbolic, given the precarious state of Iraq, the Pope's health issues, and the COVID-19 pandemic.
Cette visite, elle est symbolique en tant que telle.
He says that the visit is symbolic for Iraqi Christians as well as Christians from other parts of the Levant, but it is mostly to encourage those who have remained behind because it is doubtful that others who have emigrated to the West will return. Choir sang Chaldean religious songs to thank the Pope for his visit. Throngs also lined the road as his motorcade traveled through Erbil to return to Baghdad. Francis is due to fly back to the Vatican Monday morning. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm VOA Health Correspondent Linor Moudou. The World Health Organization and U.S. Centers for Disease Control say coughing and sneezing can spread COVID-19. Physical distancing, staying at least 1 meter away from people outside your family, can protect everyone. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa. This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm VOA Health Correspondent Linor Moudou. The World Health Organization and Africa Centers for Disease Control say we all can help fight the coronavirus pandemic by wearing face masks that cover our mouths and noses when we are in crowded areas. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest news on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
One of our avid listeners, Canon Reverend Clement Janda, died today in northern Uganda. Janda was President Kiir's former advisor and a nationalist who contributed in many ways to support South Sudan's path to independence. A lot of South Sudanese who spoke to this program described late Canon Clement Janda as a freedom fighter. We send our condolences to his family. We love to hear what you think about this show. Our WhatsApp number is +1 202 630 8011. We now leave you with the song Blessed by Eddie Kenzo.
Mulembe, mulimutie, mulembe, mulembe, mukone yomukapu, mulembe, babarambaramaramba sose, kama guaba, babarambaramaramba sinze, nesibweba. Sancho, nkede mwakumachanga nesuwa mkuba, nkoko yokumachaye koko denteme, Manyika mukama wake dendaba eme bizibu byanse no twetise mabiba. I feel blessed, oh yeah. I feel nice today. I feel blessed, I feel nice today. I'm living. They say is history. Hey, hey, hey. So why do we be telling some stories? Hey, hey, hey. I know who I am. Don't have your cola. Yes, I am. One more. Chiriwe, okuntwa langa boyagala. Bami. I feel blessed. I feel blessed. Oh yeah.
Listening to Eddie Kenzo with the song Blessed. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you're in public places to protect you and others from COVID-19. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
I feel nice, I feel nice.
matter what they say is history. Hey, hey, hey. So worry we turn down some stories. Hey, hey, hey. Babaramba, ramaramba, susu.